I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there.
Slot machines work off this thing that I call the scarcity loop, and it's got three parts. It's got opportunity, unpredictable rewards, and quick repeatability. With behaviors that fall into the scarcity loop, you can repeat over and over and over. You can put this loop in things that are other than slot machines. This is what makes social media work. It's in dating apps. It's in online shopping. Wherever it goes, it tends to lead people into excess. So tech companies are always looking for ways to speed up behavior because that increases what they call time on device, which is a term the casino industry uses and tech companies use.
Most people don't realize that their mind is being hacked all the time.
I'm not saying that people should never use social media or never play slot machines or, you know, never have a drink. I think what we're really talking about is intentionality behind it. And I think that we live in a world now where it's really easy to not do things intentionally.
Michael Easter, it's so good to have you back on the pod. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back, man. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, you know, the last time you came on, we talked about your book, Comfort Crisis. And then when I was reading this, I was thinking about how I'm so excited to look back on your writing career to see where you went, because I want to know the like underlying mission that you'll go on, you know, because you seem to be drawn into these, you have an idea and then you get drawn into these crazy adventures.
Mm-hmm.
So like, how would you define the underlying mission that sort of threads these two books, which for everybody listening, watching, Scarcity Brain is Michael's new book, and Fix Your Craving Mindset and Rewire Your Habits to Thrive with Enough, which that sounds pretty apropos to the times we're in.
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, ultimately, I'm a journalist, right? So I make an observation that oftentimes it'll be something that doesn't make sense, or I'll be like, huh, I wonder why that is. And then that leads me to chase down the answers. I mean, my job is to not just go, huh, that's interesting, and then Google it and move on with my life. My job is to literally go, okay, we need to talk to all these sources. We need to go all these places. We need to find the answer to this thing. I think what unites these two books is, you know, The Comfort Crisis is about how, as our world has become more and more comfortable, we've lost a lot of the things that keep us healthy, that keep us happy, all these important things. This book, Scarcity Brain, I mean, it really looks at why can't humans get enough? Mm-hmm. You know, I think whereas The Comfort Crisis was slightly more, maybe more of a physical book, this is more like a intellectual book. And it's more, I would say, how does our mind work in ways that oftentimes works against us?
You start off talking about Las Vegas, you know, where we are right now. Yeah. Is that what triggered it?
Yeah, it was, I would say the first part was I had finished The Comfort Crisis in March of 2020. So this is when the pandemic is popping off, the world is ending. And, you know, I make this observation that right when people realize that like, oh, the pandemic is actually like a thing, like this, we're going to lock down.
Yeah.
Everyone goes to the grocery store. Everyone thinks that the items they need to survive are scarce, right? So people are just fighting for toilet paper. We're hoarding all the hand sanitizer we can, like craziness. But then after that, you saw people start to lean into overconsumption in different ways. So a lot of people gained weight. A lot of people increased their screen time. Impulse purchasing spiked, drug and alcohol use spiked. All these behaviors that I think we would consider either bad or not good, they all started rising. And so I kind of wondered why that was. The question, what I like to say is that, you know, everyone knows that everything's fine in moderation, yet we all suck at it.
Right. So, it's so true.
Why the hell is that? Now, living in Las Vegas is a great town to think about that topic, because this town is literally built to get people in and push them out of moderation, right? Too much gambling, too much eating, too much spending, too much X, Y, Z stimulation. And so it really started, I would say, in Las Vegas, making observations about how this town works. We can get more down that rabbit hole, but it is a fascinating place to observe human behavior. Like, I really think of this town as a sort of massive laboratory for observing how humans work and behave and what leads us to overconsume.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see if things like slot machines, just by the when you land in Vegas, there is the marketing or branding of Vegas is like, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. So I wonder if just that knowing when you're coming here actually predisposes you to more excess, you know, because you're almost like anonymous in some ways, which of course you're not now in today's world, but there's a perception of that. I'd be curious to see if like a slot machine in Vegas performed more or better than a slot machine in a different place. My guess is probably not, because we are such simple animals that like, just change our place and we're like, yeah. So well, I was really intrigued by when you were looking at what makes things like slot machines really captivating.
Yeah.
And the adjustments, like you talk about a lab on the edge of, I think it's on the edge of town. Can you speak more to that and like what they study there? I mean, it's wild.
Yeah.
So we don't stand a chance, you know?
Yeah. So the, you know, like I said, Vegas is a weird town. You see a lot of weird stuff. But the strangest thing is that slot machines are everywhere. And even stranger than that is that people play them around the clock. I mean, we're talking about they're at grocery stores, they're at the gas stations, they're at restaurants. Like you just said, they're at the airport. And people play and play and play, like 6 a.m. You've probably been in the grocery store super early and there's people sitting there just ding, 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 ding,
so
ding,
ding, ding.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
And so I observed that, like I said, right at the beginning. It's like I make an observation and I go, what the hell is up with that?
Yeah. You're right? Like, I'm getting eggs. They're losing $2,000 at a freaking Whole Foods or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to find out why are slot machines so compelling, because everyone knows the house always wins, right? It's a behavior that doesn't make sense. The longer you play, the more you lose. It's simple math. So I start by calling up these people who I would consider anti-gambling researchers. And they tell me all these things that the average person has probably heard about casinos. Right? Like, oh, there's no clocks. You know, I say, why do people play slot machines so long? And they're being like, oh, well, there's no clocks in casinos. So people lose their track of time and they play and play and play. Another one told me that casinos don't have right angles, because right angles supposedly activate the decision-making part of your brain, and that slows down your rate of gambling. Another told me slot machines only play in the key of C. And the key of C is supposed to be relaxing, and it relaxes your wallet. Right. And so I'm like, okay, I mean, this sounds kind of weird, but like, all right, you have PhDs, you know? But then I go into a casino and you can pretty easily refute a lot of those claims. I mean, one, no, casinos don't have clocks, but like neither does any other business, right? Like Costco, Target, Walmart, they don't just hang clocks everywhere.
Yeah.
Right. It's not normal.
Yeah.
The right angle thing. There's right angles everywhere in casinos. Slot machine screens are a fucking square.
Yeah.
Right? And then I even call up this guy who's a slot machine music designer, what would it be called? Composer.
Yeah.
Slot machine audio composer is his official title.
What a niche.
Yes. Oh yeah, totally. And he goes, no, like, where the hell did you hear that? He's like, I'm just making music that I think sounds good. I'm going to use all the keys at my disposal. Yeah. So my problem, I realize, is that I'm calling up people who want us to all stop gambling. I need to call people who want us to start gambling.
Oh, interesting.
You got to follow the money on this one, right?
Yeah.
So long story short is, you know, it's one of those things where this person tells me to talk to this person, tells me to talk to this person. And this leads me to this place in Las Vegas that is this new cutting edge casino. It's on the edge of town, but it's used entirely for human behavior research. So you can't just like go in there and start gambling. It's a full on working casino, but it's filled with basically PhDs doing, you know, studies on how humans behave in casinos. Mm-hmm. And one of the important parts about this is that it is funded by 73 different companies. So there are gambling companies like the big ones you see on the strip, like Caesars and Boyd and all those. But there's also a bunch of tech companies involved. So like Adobe, Zoom, all these tech companies.
Interesting.
And so that's, you know, there you go. Oh, that's interesting. So while I'm there, and I can tell you it is like the Twilight Zone of casinos. Like you are in a casino, but it's, you know, it's not a casino too.
Is it blinded to the people who are there? Or do they know they're enrolling in?
Yeah. So you know you're enrolling in the site.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm. You know you're enrolling. But while I'm there, I talked to a guy who's a slot machine designer. And he helps me understand how these things work and capture behavior and push people into this decisions that hurt them in the long run. And slot machines work off this thing that I call the scarcity loop. And it's got three parts. It's got opportunity, unpredictable rewards, and quick repeatability. So you have an opportunity to get something of value. In the case of a slot machine, it's money, right? Unpredictable rewards. You know that if you keep repeating behavior, you'll get that valuable thing eventually. But you don't know when, and you don't know how big it's going to be, right? So slot machines, you play a game, the wheels spin. They could land and you get nothing. They land and you get a couple bucks. They land and you get a couple $1,000, right? So it's this crazy range of outcomes. And then third is quick repeatability, which you can repeat the behavior immediately. And this is unlike normal human behaviors. Like if you have an itch and you scratch it, you know the itch is going to go away.
Yeah.
Right? You do the thing and you're done. That's it. But with behaviors that fall into the scarcity loop, you can repeat and repeat and repeat over and over and over. Pretty much forever if you really wanted to. And so then you go back to, okay, well, why are all these companies invested in this place? And that's because you can put this loop in things that are other than slot machines, right? And it'll lead people to repeat behaviors. So this is what makes social media work. It's in dating apps. It's in elements of it are really getting put into new financial apps. I think it's in online shopping in a lot of ways. And it's kind of one of those things that like wherever it goes, it tends to lead people into excess, tends to push them into behaviors that are fun in the short term, because it is fun to gamble in the short term. It is fun to buy crap you don't need online in the short term, but long-term problems. So like with gambling, eventually you end up spending too much. With shopping, you buy all this crap you don't need, on and on and on.
When I was reading, one thing that you mentioned is that when they switch from a button, from an arm to a button, it was like a dramatic increase just because of the level, because you were saying repeatability. So it's easier for me to go tap, tap, tap. And you talk about some research on pigeons. Can you share, which I think for you listening, you might be like, pigeons, how does that relate to humans? Unfortunately, quite well.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So the button thing is really interesting. When they when they switched that, it more than doubled the rate at which people gamble. So now people play about 900 games in an hour on slot machines. So that's more than we blink. So it's like you can just do.
That's bananas.
It's crazy. It's totally crazy. But as a general rule, the faster you can repeat a behavior, the more likely you are to repeat it. So time will... just even inserting the element of time and weight will stop people from doing something, decreases the likelihood that they'll do something.
If it takes longer to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to repeat it.
Yeah. Quickly. So here's a good example. If, let's say with Instagram, in order to look at the photos, you had to flick them side to side, every single photo, you had to flick it side to side and there was like a 2 second wait. How much time would you spend on Instagram? Not a lot.
Everyone would be off it.
Instead, we have infinite scroll.
Yeah.
It goes seamlessly into the next one. There's zero wait. You can start to see the next one before you finish looking at the other one, right? So tech companies are always looking for ways to speed up behavior because that increases what they call time on device, which is a term the casino industry uses and tech companies use. But to answer your question about pigeons. So once I talk to this slot machine designer guy, I go, okay, like, but why? Why is this thing so, like, why are we so pulled into this? And he just is like, I don't know, dude. Like,
this is just how it works. Yeah.
I just make money off it. Like, leave me alone. So I called this dude whose name is Thomas Zental, and he's this old school behavioral psychologist. He's like 80 something. He still spends, I think it's 60 hours a week in the lab.
Wow.
Like, I mean, he's just like loves his job. And he's done these studies where he can train pigeons to basically become degenerate gamblers, like very quickly. So he will, what he does is he's got these pigeons who are in, you know, the cages or whatever, and he will put them in a cage that has two different games. So in the first game, they peck a light, and every other time they peck, they get 15 units of food. Okay. The second game, about every fifth peck, they get 20 units of food. So this is more like a gambling game because they don't know. It's not like it's every first one out of five. It could be the third one out of the five one time. And then it's the second one out of the five. So it's unpredictable. It's just like a slot machine, but they get a little bit more food. Now, if you do the math, it makes much more sense to play the first game. Because if you play that, say, 100 times, you're going to end up with significantly more food than if you were to have played the second game. Now, there's this theory called optimal foraging theory. And it basically says that animals will do whatever they can, put in the least amount of effort to get the most food possible.
That hits, yeah.
Right. So you go, okay, based on this theory that we've seen in the wild, these pigeons should all be playing the first game. And what he finds is that 97% of pigeons will play the gambling game, the one that gets them less food. Yeah.
So did you find that when you were learning about things like this, that they were studying, let's say, pigeons, and that they're making these machines so accessible to extract every dollar from your bank account? That, like, if you're not conscious of what, you know, the scarcity loop, that you just end up in it. And I've been in it. I get in it. I'm sure everybody listening, if you don't, tell us your secrets. But did you get angry at all that there's such an exploitation of this biological drive or this, I guess it's like a software that's running in us?
Yeah. So once the guy tells me about his pigeon study,
you're
like, whoa. So like all animals will choose this, you know, scarcity loop gambling game. His theory about why goes back to evolution and how we evolved to find food.
Yeah.
So if you think about finding food, it's basically a random rewards game, which is just like a slot machine. You go to one place looking for food because you need the food to survive, right? That's the opportunity. But it's unpredictable, right? You don't know where the food's going to be. You go to one place, it's not there. You go to the next place, no food. Next place, jackpot. You've got enough food to survive. That is insanely exciting.
Yeah.
Because, oh, great, we're not going to die.
Like, right.
That's a good day. Yeah. And you repeat that literally all day for life. So this system, our attraction to this system is sort of wired into our brain. We just focus and hone in on these unpredictable reward games, which good because it kept us alive for millions of years. But now once you put that same system in things like slot machines and things like social media and things like, I don't know, Twitter, even people getting hooked on email, financial apps, all these different things. You can see how, I don't know, maybe we don't want to be spending as much time as we do. And it really is like, I like to explain it as it's if you fall into overdoing any of these things, it's not necessarily your fault because it's a very human thing to do, but it is your problem to solve.
Yeah.
And so to answer your question, did I get frustrated? I mean, part of it was, I would say sometimes I would. On the other hand, the opposite, if you were to take that to reasonable, okay, I'm really frustrated, we got to do something about this. Well, then the question is, okay, well, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah.
And the only way to really slow down these behaviors would be to make them all a lot more boring. And so we would have to go, okay, if we don't want
that's the alternative shit.
Yeah. If we don't want people to gamble, we have to make gambling not fun. If we don't want people to spend time on Instagram, we have to ask Instagram to please censor videos that are too exciting and make people laugh too much and capture our attention. Yeah. Right. And I'm not saying you should never like censor content or put wheels on it. Like the gambling industry is pretty heavily regulated, for example. But I do think it's really a question of, I think it's a better use of resources to put the onus on the individual and be like, okay, we need to figure out how you can manage these things. Because the reality is like, if you take something like gambling, like most people in the world can gamble and they have fun. They don't lose that much money. They're like, okay, yeah, I have my $100 for the, you know, the Saturday night. I'm only going to gamble with this. And maybe they win some, great. They lose their $100 and they're like, okay, well, that was kind of fun. I'm going home. A small percentage, though, will gamble their life away.
Yeah.
And that's with every single behavior that can be maladaptive. That's with alcohol. That's with gambling. That's with online shopping. That's with time online. That's with all these things. There's always going to be this small percentage of people that just do it to such an excess that it ruins their life. But for the vast majority of people, we can kind of keep it on the rails. And so I think trying to overly regulate it to sort of save the butts of the right. people who can't. It's like, because you never know what it's going to be for someone, right? It's like, you know, for example, I'm sober. I don't drink because I was one of those people who can't regulate alcohol. But for me to get out of that, I couldn't sit around waiting for the government to be like,
yeah, you know, Michael, you have a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd like to help.
Exactly. Right. So I had to kind of figure that out for myself. And I think that's how, if, you know, if people do are struggling with behaviors that are really hurting them, the onus is sort of on them, you know.
Do you think because society has sort of normalized this engagement with excess that people would even identify that they're in a state of excess?
Well, I think that it's very easy to see societally if it's something like drugs or alcohol, you know, because there's such stigma around that, or gambling, for example.
Yeah.
I don't think it's quite as apparent for things like, say, shopping. Or, I mean, it's becoming more apparent, I think, for time online as we get more conscious about that.
Yeah.
But even that, you know, I'll do days where I'm a professor at UNLV, where I'll have my students kind of take an audit of their screen time, and I'll have students who are spending, you know, more than 10 hours a day on their phones, and it's mainly on TikTok. And like, to me, that's just like being a junkie.
Right. You're like,
but it's on this app but no one really, you know, no one's going to be like, dude, you need to go to rehab for that. Right.
Right.
So I think that there are some behaviors that we think of as, you know, society just generally accepts, even though they're, I think, hurting people in the long term.
Well, it's interesting because I think of someone being, let's say, on TikTok for that many hours, and I'm grateful that I never got captured by the TikTok thing, which TikTok changed how it displayed content, because it went from, you know, Instagram, you follow 100 people, you get that 100 people's content originally.
Mm-hmm.
And TikTok was like, yeah, like you could follow those 100 people. That's great. We'll show you their stuff every once in a while. But we're actually going to create an algorithm that identifies what you look at and then what you engage with most and spend the most time on. And we're going to like pop some of those in there, which that makes me think of the pigeon. It's like peck, peck, like slide, slide. Oh. Uh-oh, slide, slide. And I mean, I've definitely done that where I'm like, oh, I'm going to go on and look up this thing or do this email. And all of a sudden I'm looking at YouTube shorts or something. You know what I mean? Like so when I think about someone being captured, like a young person like that or anybody, because I'm sure there's people of every age captured by social media and TikTok. Maybe the savior or the like martyr-y feeling is like they don't stand a chance. But if they know about it, at least they have a bit of a chance, you know? Because for me, reading your book really, it created this pattern recognition of where the scarcity loop existed. And I was like, shit is everywhere.
Oh, it's everywhere.
Yeah. And it seems like since COVID that it's really so much more amplified. And I know you were saying at the beginning, like, we went so online at that time, mm-hmm. and like, we weren't at work, we weren't driving to work generally. Not everybody, obviously, but like, I know you say the onus is really on the individual, and I totally agree with that. I just wonder how we even ourselves can minimize or moderate. Mm-hmm. How do we capture the loop? Like, how do I, okay, I know that TikTok is 7 hours a day or whatever. Mm-hmm. I know that I love porn. I know that I love gambling. Fuck. Like, I'm like you with drinking. I don't drink anymore because I was really good at it.
Yeah.
But, not, you know, it has consequences.
Yeah.
TikTok doesn't have immediate consequences.
Right. You it's know? Harder to see.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah. No one wakes up after a TikTok binge and goes, where's my car?
Right.
What did right, I do right. last night?
Who did I scroll last night?
Yeah.
You know?
Totally. So I think that one, as you kind of pointed out, just becoming aware of like how it works is useful.
Yeah.
This leverages something called the Hawthorne effect, where basically when behaviors are observed, they tend to change. Two is that you can remove or change any of the three parts. So you can take away or change the opportunity. You can take away or change the unpredictable rewards. You can take away or change how fast the behavior is. So you can slow down the behavior, basically. So when I think about something like opportunity, it's like, let's say you're kind of in this loop of shopping. Well, a lot of people buy stuff for reasons they haven't even thought of. Right?
That's true.
It's like framing your possessions. So in the book, I talk about framing possessions through this lens of gear, not stuff. Because gear, inherently, it's something you use for something that allows you to achieve a higher purpose.
Mm.
Where I think a lot of times like people that. Will buy stuff because, frankly, they're bored. Because they think, oh, if I just buy this thing, and let's say it's a piece of clothes, like I'm going to look a certain way, and like that is going to open up the world for me socially, right? We kind of manufacture these narratives in our head about like what a certain purchase is going to allow us to do in the future, but it's like this grand weird thing that's like socially. Yeah. And sometimes we purchase for status too, you know, it's like, yeah. I need to have this item because it'll make me, you know, just whatever, better person. So I think like thinking of what the opportunity of a behavior is, like, why am I really doing this is the fundamental question we're asking here. And then asking yourself, okay, is that a good reason for doing yeah. this? And if it isn't, what else could I do? Like what are better ways to spend my time? When you think of unpredictable rewards, a good one, that sounds weird, but totally works, demonstrated in studies with cell phone is, screen colors are very stimulating and they stimulate behavior. So if you think of like red, if you see a red octagon on the street, it tells you to stop.
Yeah.
Right. So colors just, they excite us. So if you can put your phone into grayscale mode, on average, people's screen time drops by at least 40 minutes a day. And that's wow. simply because your phone all of a sudden is now less rewarding. It's quite boring, actually.
That makes sense, actually, watching videos in grayscale versus, of course, color.
It's crazy. How, and at first, like I've done this.
Yeah, I've done that too.
You'll start to kind of like, it's weird.
Yeah.
But your screen time immediately goes down. And then slowing down how fast you can repeat a behavior. So I talked about, I can't remember if this is before or after we were recording, putting in a pause of if you're purchasing too much stuff, like, okay, I'm going to only purchase stuff in person. Because it used to be that you had to go in person to buy things.
Yeah.
Right. And now you can just do it straight from your phone. Or I'm going to put in a 7-day holding period on any online purchases. And I guarantee once you have that seventh day, your likelihood of actually buying yeah. that thing that you thought was like such a great idea, you're like, oh, maybe I actually don't need to do this. Right. And you can apply that to any of the things I look at in the book. So the book really looks at these things that were more or less built to crave, everything from food to stuff. Information, status and influence, et cetera.
What is the experience though that we have to sit through or understand between the interruption of the loop?
Oh, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. You're like, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So how do you encourage people be with that? solve all of humanity's crises.
I do think it's a noticing, and I do think it's one of those things where there's not an easy answer.
Yeah.
It is just like, okay, can I become aware of it?
Yeah.
As I'm aware of it, how does this feel? How bad is it? And I think most of the time, you know, the first handful of times you do anything new, that's a change in a behavior that might be a harder behavior, the harder choice to make. It is challenging, but the more you do it, the easier it becomes. It's like exercise.
Yeah.
If you haven't gone for a run in 10 years and you go for a run, you might feel like you're going to die in 2 miles.
Right.
But then you do it 2 days later. And you're like, okay, I felt pretty close to death, but not as bad. And then you repeat that and repeat that. And all of a sudden it's like 2 miles is nothing. You know, so you're just sort of cementing that. And I think that we need to be honest with ourselves that like changing behaviors is never going to be easy. Cause like once you've cemented a behavior, it just becomes sort of second nature. And we often do things because they make us feel good or are easier.
I think we so often too don't want to acknowledge that we're driven by biological processes. Mm-hmm. Like I think one of the arrogances of being human for the most part is the concept that we have free will. And then because we have this idea that we're conscious, we're better, we're conscious of how we think, ideally, which I think is probably the first step of any level of self-awareness. But we look at other animals and we're like, look at them, these simpletons. Like they just follow their instincts. Like they don't, you know, as where we seem to think that we are not susceptible to things like a scarcity loop. Like most people don't realize that their mind is being hacked all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get, as you know, as I was saying earlier, we get to the place like, woe is me, that's not fair. But shit, as you were saying, it might not be your fault. And it isn't your fault, really. But you better do something about it. Because just like with drinking, I think of like, you look at the world today and you look at the consequence of the exploitation of this loop. What do you see?
Oh, the consequence? I mean, the biggest thing to me, honestly, is, I'll answer it like this. One of my favorite quotes ever is from William James. And he basically said that when you die, your life is basically will have been a culmination of what you were aware of. And now you look at how people spend their time. And it is often in these behaviors that we're not going to look back on and be like, wow, I'm really glad I spent my time that way.
Yeah.
So the average person now spends 12 to 13 hours on digital media. I am not saying all
every
that
day.
Is bad every day. I'm not saying all that is bad at all.
Yeah.
But I think when you start to break it down, you look at, okay, person's like 4 hours on their phone. Okay, well, where's that time coming from? And it's like, all right, we got 1.5 hours on, say, Instagram, 30 minutes on TikTok, bunch of time on Twitter, another time on Reddit, you know, or, you know, it's TV, it's like 4 hours and you're watching 4 hours of that a day. You're not watching the good shit on Netflix anymore. You're bottom of the barrel stuff, right? You're just looking for something. And so I think once you kind of frame it with that, my big thing is like, you've got one ride.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is spent, I think, and I'm guilty of this too, where you're just kind of like, you're just doing the next thing that's like kind of stimulating, but it's ultimately not the use of your time as you really, I think, if you sat down intentionally and tried to spend it, would be.
Well, yeah, like you look back pre-smartphone and you didn't have this opportunity. I mean, doom scrolling, especially, you didn't have this opportunity to have an endless loop of your attention. You experienced boredom, which of course leads to creativity. You experience, and it creates ideation. It creates all these things. You also have more time to have conversations. And I think you're naturally exposed by the serendipity of making your way through a real world, not a digital world. And not to minimize the digital world, great. It exposes us to information. We met through it. You know, like there's value in these things. But if not moderated by us, they are by ourselves and our own behaviors. Like I think about if you were, you know, in 1993, throwback time, you know, you're like going to the store, you had to meet your friends at the mall. You had to meet them. You like got off the home phone and caught the bus or your parents dropped you off or whatever. You rode your bike, but you had to go. And now it's easier for us to flake. It's easier for us to have multiple connections. Like I think about now, if you want to, you know, be a player, it's a lot easier. Like before, you had to get on a horse, ride to a woman's house or whatever, or like whatever that looks like. Now, and the dad probably had a gun or a sword, you know, now you're like, oh, you can text tons of people. You can do all these things. So when I look at it, I'm like the opportunity just by not going into an echo chamber of a phone, which an algorithm provides, is not, that's not even anyone's fault either, is that we are not even exposed to diverse thought anymore. We're not exposed to diverse experience. And when I think about your, and we talked a bit about this in the first podcast we did, this like absence of comfort, not just on a, or sorry, an absence of discomfort, not just on a physicality level, but like psychologically and from an ideological perspective, we are, it's interesting because as I say this, I want to just explore this with you. We are one, either in echo chambers where we don't experience psychological discomfort, and cancel culture, I think, really contributed to that. This like, you can't talk about that. You're not. And there's obviously value in why we did, why there was an experience of cancel culture, because there was an absence of accountability. And you talk in the book about like people like Trump in the news media and how there is also this appeal of, I guess, what do you call it? Like rage or like, why did he spend so much more time in the media loop? And why does media put, like, have they been reporting more bad stories than before?
Yeah. So I think that you hit the nail on the head. It's that, you know, a lot of the behaviors that fall into the scarcity loop, they are sort of comforting. It's like a mild level of comfort. And you're not, you know, take boredom, which we talked about that in the last podcast too. In the past, if you're exposed to boredom, you'd have to sit with the discomfort and then you'd have to be like, okay, where's this boredom going to take me?
Yeah.
So boredom is this evolutionary discomfort that basically tells you whatever you're doing with your time right now, the return on your time invested has worn thin. So go do something else.
Yeah.
Now in the past, that something else was often productive, right?
Yeah.
Or at least kind of new and interesting.
Go forage, go hunt, go have a conversation with some other person in your tribe.
Right. And now when we feel that, we have an easy, effortless escape from it on our persons all the time. And I think you can apply that across the board. But I often think that, you know, having to go through these uncomfortable moments and not do the next easiest thing all the time, that ultimately leads to more growth and productivity, creativity, all these good things that we want humans to have. To your point, I'm not saying that people should never use social media or never play slot machines or, you know, never have a drink or like, no, not at all. I think what we're really talking about is intentionality behind it. And I think that we live in a world now where it's really easy to not do things intentionally because of things like algorithms. To answer your question with the Trump thing is that I think basically people's attentions gravitate to things like outrage and outrage. And I guess I can't think of the right word, but sort of butting of heads,
opposition,
right? Controversy.
Yeah.
And so I think that one of the reasons that depends on like, let's just put politics aside and say like, I don't really care what you think about his politics. When you think about him just from a media capture standpoint, he is by far the smartest media mind who has ever lived. No one has gotten more attention than Donald Trump ever.
I agree with that. And I mean, it's obvious. The proof is in the numbers.
Right.
Right.
And it's like, well, why is that? And it's because he came into a world of politics that is, it's important in people's lives, and he made it less boring. That's exactly how slot machines took off. Slot machines took off in 1980 when we made them less boring by doing all these different tweaks to them. Right. So he, and part of the reason why he, probably the main reason he's not boring is because there's a level of unpredictability, a high level of unpredictability. What is he going to say, do, or tweet next? So he might say something that is actually kind of nice. You're like, oh, look at that. And then the next thing, he might say something just totally like you've never heard a politician say anything like that before. And, you know, you might be on the side that goes, I can't believe a politician would say that. God damn him.
Yeah.
Or you might be on the side that's like, this is how real people talk. Like, it's good to see a politician actually saying what normal people say in conversations without having to filter themselves, right? So there's this inherent level of unpredictability and behaviors that are very unpredictable, and that captures attention. Now, you know, you might think that, oh, I'm blaming Trump or something like that. I don't blame that at all. I think that you're seeing it from politicians on all sides of the aisle.
Right,
now.
Right. A lot learned from that. And I'd say all the people who are really sort of the most media focused when they'll pick up a story from them in a tabloid are people who are unpredictable, controversial. We like to watch people's failures too, which is really crazy. But, you know, it's like, we like, you know, what's that idea of like, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so true. There's been such an amplification of that. When I think about you didn't know about a war across the world back in the day.
Right.
You know, and now you know about a lot of conflicts, but they don't report on every conflict. You know about the ones that perhaps media selects to highlight a little more for whatever agenda that might be. But I look at things like I know one person, but I'm sure this is true of many people. And I've had someone mention Trump on my podcast, and then all of a sudden you get a review because someone, you know, spoke poorly about him or positively about him, which is, it just shows how oppositional, you know, you said that controversy, which I think social media, when I think of young people today, has really amplified that, these like ideological bubbles. Mm-hmm. Like one person I know specifically would Google Trump's name every night before bed and was like obsessed with the news about him, a Canadian, which I think is really like kind of funny because our politics used to be, it's getting a little more exciting, but used to be so boring that we were just consumed by American politics. But that their whole life was being enraged by him. And every conversation I would have with them was seemingly would be brought back, especially when I'm living here or spending a lot of time here. Was like, oh, what is it like talking to people and engaging about the subject of? And I'm like, I don't even think about it. I don't even, because I'm not engaged in the news. Because for me, I did what you said. It was like, just turn down the volume. I'm not exposed. The opportunity is not there. Yeah.
Well, I think that, so something I talk about in the book is, I'll say two things, is that 90% of news is negative. And that holds across time. And so then you have to go, okay, has the world stayed, is the world itself 90% negative? I don't think it is.
No.
Let's compare now to 100 years ago. You're less likely to die at any given moment. You're going to live longer. You're less likely to be hungry. You're less likely to be in the front lines of World War I without any antiseptic.
Right.
Like all these things. But the news is still going to tell you all of these bad things. And I think that colors our worldview because I think that right now is the best time to be alive, you know, when you just look at it. But when you poll people, only 6% of people think the world is improving. And that's because,
that's so low.
Yeah. 6%. And I think it is because we're surrounded with so much information, that is negative. Now, the reason for that is because we gravitate to information that's negative. Like our attention focuses on that.
Yeah.
And that's an evolutionary.
Yeah, negativity bias.
Yeah. It's just a hack that saved us in the past. You don't want to be the caveman who is looking at the nice flower going, oh, that's so beautiful as a saber-toothed tiger comes in on the side, right? That person dies. That person doesn't spread their DNA. You want to be the person who like you hear a twig and you're like, it's definitely a grizzly bear. We're definitely going to die, right?
Yeah.
So we still have that. And what else I'll say is, sort of about needing unpredictability in order to get attention. The first season of MTV's The Real World, which you know that show.
Yeah.
This was one of the very first reality shows. The producers, they interviewed all these people and they got all these nice kids that were like, oh yeah, these are great kids. This is going to be great. They put them in a house. They put cameras on them. And the problem was that the people were normal. So you're watching a show of normal people being like, yeah, so what are you going to have for breakfast? Oh, do you want to go on a walk later? Okay. Maybe we could go have a nice dinner later. This is boring as hell.
So no one's watching that.
Right. No one's watching that. What you need for reality to work, reality shows, is you need to cast people who have elements of unpredictability, who are crazy. You need the people who are going to drink too much, who are going to fly off the handle, who like, you know, are going to get in fights, who are going to say some crazy shit. So it selects for that. And I think that that is analogous almost to, in a lot of ways, where our political world is going in such a way, and just where entertainment in general is going. You have to select for the crazy people.
Yeah, I remember being captured by a season of The Bachelor.
Yeah.
And one of the characters that really captured me was someone who was just totally unpredictable. He was gaslighting. He was so manipulative. And then I was talking to a buddy of mine who was on The Bachelor, and they had asked him if he wanted to be like the main one. He had been on The Bachelorette. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me that when they cast it, he said, like, they give you a heads up, like, yeah, there's in the rose ceremony, like, you're going to give roses to who you want to, but there's a few that we need you to give them to. Like, they're just getting through.
Yeah.
Because they have that element. He's like, you'd never pick them. Like, you knew in the first time you met him, not happening. But he's like, you got to keep him. Which I was like, that's so true. Because when I looked at my experience of that season, which was also that show Love is Blind.
Okay, yeah.
Have you seen that one?
I've seen a couple episodes, yeah.
Yeah, where there is like such a mystery to it. But you hear people say horrendous shit. Which, of course, is what makes movies like The Notebook exciting, is the unavailability. And there's a show called Normal People that had a huge following. The show itself is fucking heart-wrenching. It's like they almost are together and then they're not. And she's like leading them on. She keeps them secret. And you're like, oh, I got to keep watching this, hoping it resolves. And it never, never gives you what you're seeking, which is, of course, the freaking whole point of it, which is good writing, good story writing, because it keeps us in this like desire to follow sort of the hero's journey.
Yeah. Here's a great example, especially for your audience, of the scarcity loop. So people tend to get stuck in abusive relationships when the abusive relationship is unpredictable. If someone just consistently is an asshole and consistently a jerk and consistently emotionally abusive, you'll leave them. It's when they were an asshole, they're an asshole. Oh, but then they were so nice this time.
Yeah.
Then they're an asshole, then they're a jerk. Oh, but then they brought flowers and we went to dinner and they were so nice. That unpredictability of behavior, you start to look for the wins, just like a slot machine player. Play, no win. Play, no win. Play, no win. Oh, we won. Okay, let's do it again. Yeah, that's that was identified by a behavioral psychologist named Karen Pryor. She writes about it. And once you realize that, it's like, oh, it's because I'm getting these little wins every now and then.
Yeah.
When I look at the totality of this, 80% of the behavior is that of an asshole.
Right, right.
Do I want that in my life? No, but I'm getting hooked on the unpredictability because I don't know how the person's going to behave this time around. And that captures people and keeps them in bad relationships.
It's good for people to know, because for sure, what you hear someone say is like, oh yeah, but you hear that conversation about addicts too. It's like, but they showed this moment of, and I'm like, of course they did.
Right.
But I really think, you know, we are often, like, we like to say something when we make a poor choice or do something we're ashamed of. We're like, but that's not who I am. Mm-hmm. I'm like, but yeah, there's actually something liberating by saying that's actually who you are sometimes. Mm-hmm. And if you can be with that truth, just like I tolerate bullshit, but that's not who I am. But no, it is. That's the life you're going to get if you keep doing that. I was really interested in how dating apps use this. What did you see with that? With like things like Bumble, Tinder, like just how people get caught in that?
Oh yeah. Well, it's an unpredictable rewards game, right? It's swipe, swipe, swipe,
right.
Swipe, match. And then who is it?
Yeah, you have a match.
Yeah. Is it the person that I was like, they're okay. I mean, maybe. All right, we'll just swipe for it, you know? Or is it the person where you're like, whoa, that person's incredible, you know? And you don't, and then you do it again and again and again. So Tinder made so much money. I think they're the highest grossing app of all time.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Because, I didn't know that.
Because what they did is, you would have this unpredictable reward game experience that was fun where you're matching with people, but then you could pay for things like, I think they call them boosts. And so that would increase the amount of people who are seeing your profile. And then it's almost like being able to be like, okay, I'm going to pay a little bit extra money on the slot machine and I'm going to get more jackpots. Like, you'll do that, right? But it's free to start. So it's free to start. You have a good time. And it's like, oh, by the way, if you just pay us like whatever, $5, $10, $15, I have no idea what the economics were. You would get, your profile would get seen by more people. You would have more matches and you would have a better experience.
So you get more rewards, which I remember being on Tinder or Bumble years ago. And when I remember being in New York and like swiping through, and I can't remember what my radius of match was, but it wasn't that high. And all of a sudden it was like just me and a radar. Like there's no one around. You're all alone. You'll never find anybody.
Yeah.
And so then I would increase my radius. Like, I could match with someone from Brooklyn or someone from Jersey or whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the paid app things that you could pay for was that you could change your city. So before you could only do it in your origin city, but you could like pay to be, you know, go, oh, I travel there.
Yeah.
I'm going there for a trip. So maybe I should get a match ahead of time.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how they monetize because opportunity. I want more opportunity. So right. I'll pay for more opportunity. Yeah. A lot of these endless scroll things like Instagram are not monetizing you in that moment though. Right? Your opportunity is new content, but you're actually not, you're not spending money, I guess, till you see an ad or something that catches you.
Well, they're monetizing you in the sense that they're selling you. They're selling your attention to advertisers.
Yeah, good point.
So back to this three-part system: opportunity, unpredictable rewards, quick repeatability. So with Tinder, opportunity to get a mate, unpredictable rewards. I don't know who it is. I don't know when I'm going to find this person. And quick repeatability. I just got to keep swiping and swiping and swiping. And eventually I'll get the jackpot. With Instagram, it could be you have an opportunity for status. So this would be something like social posts. Like I'm going to post, right? I have an opportunity to get likes and acceptance from people. So I post and then the rewards are unpredictable. I don't know if this post is going to get a lot of likes,
right?
That's awesome. Or it could just get a few. And that sucks. Could even be that someone comments on it and says, you're an idiot. Oh, that's not fun at all, right? So there's this range of outcomes. And then what do people do after they post? They check and recheck to see like what's happening on the post. Like has someone commented? Has someone given me a like, et cetera? And then with the swiping, it's the same deal. You have an opportunity to get some piece of content that'll make you feel something.
Yeah.
Right? It could make you laugh, could make you feel nostalgic. It could make you really angry. You keep scrolling and scrolling. You're going through all those videos and then it hits. You get that brief hit, right? You get the dog video that makes you laugh your ass off. And then you keep swiping.
Mm-hmm. I know in the book you talk about cravings.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you find out about why we crave things?
Well, I look at what we're sort of built to crave. And it all goes back to scarcity and how we evolved. So there's these, humans really crave things like food, possessions, information, status over others. And when you think about all those things, they were scarce in the past, right? So take food.
Yeah.
There was never that much food. You didn't know where it was. It was hard to find. It took effort to find. And so we are designed to basically, when we find food, to overeat it, try and pack on weight because it was going to be scarce again. And that kept us alive. So all these things that kept us alive, food, stuff, information, status, whatever, were scarce and hard to find in the past. So we've sort of evolved to crave them and consistently want to overdo them. It never made sense to moderate on all these things, right? Because there just wasn't enough of them. And now we live in a world where we have an abundance of all these things. So we throw out a third of our food, for example. Like we have so much food, we're throwing out a ton of it. Not to mention our food is super hypercaloric. The average home, possession-wise, now has more than 10,000 items. In the past, the house might have had like 100 items.
10,000.
10,000 to 40,000 is the numbers I've seen. And that's counting everything big and small, right? With information, we now see more information in a single day than we would have seen in our entire life about 700 years ago. When you think of status, it used to be, how many people were you going to influence in a day?
Right.
Maybe, I mean, people's tribes rarely got over 150 people. So you kind of knew how everything worked. You can only influence so many people. And now you can go online and put something online that influences the behavior of thousands and maybe even millions of people all at once. And we have you know, like for example, with social media, your sort of status or influence is ranked. It's quantified. You have X amount of friends or followers or whatever it is. You have X amount of likes. And that's different than we've ever had to deal with in the past. And so just all these changes to our environment and these things that we are built to crave, I think has in turn changed us.
Why do you think we can't move from this space of, we would normally, as you were saying, any of those things we would want to accumulate because there was a chance they would go away. There was a chance we wouldn't find more. Status inferred likely a lot more safety, more mate options, all that kind of stuff, which you see all those things being exploited in the advertising.
Yeah.
You know, so how do we move from being driven by scarcity to being driven by abundance? Because a lot of people, I'm sure, listening are like, there's not abundance, you know, or that's bypassing the reality of a scarce world or, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would say to that is, I mean, we can kind of split hairs all day, but the reality is that we have more of these things that we're built to crave than any other time in the world. And here's how I'll answer your question. So going back to the guy with the gambling pigeons, okay, we learned that, you know, 97% of them will choose the game that gets them less food.
97%
choose to gamble. 97% choose to gamble. They choose to not get the game that is the better use of their time, realistically, right? But what he finds is that, so these pigeons, they live in these small cages, relatively small. They're kind of cooped up. The researchers are like, yeah, they seem to have decent lives. Like they're just in these cages, whatever. He did this experiment where he put them in this really big cage and it was designed just like the wild. So the pigeons had to basically work to exist. They had to build nests. They had to go find food. They would go up onto cliffs, which is like where pigeons like to hang out in the wild. They would hang out with their other pigeon friends, whatever. They do these things that pigeons are designed to do. And then he would put them back in the game. And literally every single one chose the smarter game. The game won.
Wow.
Yeah. And from there, the guys goes, and when you think of humans today, we live a lot different lives than we did in the past, right? We don't have to be active. We don't have to forage for food. Our social connections aren't like they were in the past. On and on and on, right? Because in the past, we were working hard all the time. We were present in the environment, having to do things to make sure that we could live on another day. But today we don't have that, right? Everything's changed. And he said, you know, when you think of us today, I think when we don't have these sort of fundamental needs met, we search for stimulation from something else. We gamble, we drink too much, we buy too much stuff, we spend too much time on social media. And it all goes back to this idea that's called the optimal stimulation theory. And it basically suggests that all animals need a certain amount of stimulation in their life to sort of be well. Mm-hmm. And if they don't get it, we go looking for it from somewhere else. So these pigeons cooped up in their cages, they're getting stimulation from the gambling game, right? It's giving them something that's just capturing their attention and making them feel like they're moving.
They don't have liberate. They're not free. They're not. Yeah.
Right. And so I think when you sort of apply that to humans, it's like, what can I do that's going to give me deeper meaning? And it's probably not going to be the easiest thing, right? Yeah. Could be more time outdoors, developing some hobby that helps others, volunteering, finding some bigger thing that takes your time and effort in a place that is highly stimulating, but leads to a long-term reward. Because right now we live in a world where we have all these different behaviors we can do that are fun in the short term, that are stimulating in the short term, but they're detrimental in the long run.
Yeah.
So how can I find behaviors that are might be a little bit challenging in the short term? They're not going to be as fun as scrolling Instagram mindlessly or playing a slot machine. Have elements of challenge, but give me these long-term rewards that keep me healthier and happier over time.
Do you think it's a fair argument to make that the presence of the 97% being probably accurate to our actual population distribution of addiction to devices and shopping and all those things? I think about those 3% of pigeons. I'm like, way to go. We need to breed those pigeons. We need to do the same with people. Yeah. But I'm curious, do you think it is evidence that as a society, like if you have an addiction to TikTok, it means you have an absence of meaning. It means that you have an absence of maybe deeper connections, all these things that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think if you have an addiction, then totally. Yeah, I really see addiction as a symptom of some underlying problem. You know, I think we've traditionally in the US, we've thought of addiction two different ways. We've thought of it as the person being a bad person, right? They're making this like selfish, terrible choice. So put them in jail, you know, with drug addiction. Or we've thought of it as a brain disease where it's like this person just has this like, they have zero agency. It's all just like these brain chemicals that are leading them to
predisposition.
Yeah. And by the way, the brain disease model says that it's a compulsive behavior that you're probably not going to get out of.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that neither one is right. Like, yeah, I definitely don't think that addicts are bad people at all. But I also don't, I also think that sort of boiling down addiction to like, oh, this chemical fire's here, that's not it either, right? I think you tend to see that people who get addicted to something have something missing in their lives.
Yeah.
And I can talk from that. I can talk about that because that's why I drank. So I think you do need to figure out, okay, why am I doing this? What am I missing? What am I searching for here? And the answers aren't always so clear. You know, there's a lot of different reasons why people become addicted to behaviors, but I think you need to find the underlying reason and start to take actions to solve it. Are those actions going to be easy? Hell no.
No.
They're not going to be. But I really do think that the story of growth today is being willing to go through short-term discomfort to find a long-term benefit. All right. So it's like when I got sober, that sucked. It's like the hardest thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like hell for a while. But by going through that, my life started improving like fundamentally. And every day started getting better. And I could start to peel away the layers of like, okay, well, like, why the hell were you drinking in the first place? Like that, dude. And then I could go, okay, I think this is why. And then I could start to insert ways that got me that why that were more productive, that actually enhanced my life. And it just led to more improvements over time. So for example, for me, I think a lot of it is just that like, I'm a person who seeks out extreme experiences. I like to explore the edges. And at the time I was working a job that was pretty boring. It was an office job, kind of doing the same thing every day that I wasn't super passionate about. And so alcohol on the weekends would give me this opportunity to sort of be like wild and free and explore those edges in this world that's increasingly sanitary and rule-based. So once I get sober, I need to find a way to explore the edges and find extreme experiences in a way that enhances my life.
Found that.
Yeah. So now it's like my reporting trips. Now time outside doing exercising, like that's going to enhance my life in the long term. I mean, I've built a career off of basically changing this thing I was thinking in addiction to like something that I can actually sell people in the form of books. And my life has gotten better for it.
When you look at a behavior, how do you identify, like, where's the line if TikTok's addictive or contributing to your life?
Yeah, I think that, I think with addiction, honestly, there's not really a line.
Yeah.
Here's how I'll answer that is like the DSM-5, which is the sort of Bible for the psychiatrists use to make diagnosis. It doesn't even include the word addiction. It's not even in the entire thing. And the thing's like 500, whatever pages.
Crazy how many other things are in there.
Yeah. They use substance use disorder. And they basically say it's substance use, like addiction is hard to define, basically. They give this criteria. There's 11 different questions they ask to help figure out, like, does this person have a use disorder?
Yeah.
And so if you answer yes to say 2 to 5 of these questions, you got a mild case. 6 to 8, you got a medium case. 9 or more, you got an extreme case. Now, the funny part of this is that, you know, when I go through it thinking through my lens of someone who drinks, I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of yeses there, you know? Mm-hmm. But then I could go, okay, well, what about my use of insert X app that I feel like I use too much? I'm like, oh shit. Like I answered yes to like 3 of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think kind of going, like realizing that sort of these behaviors that we believe we overdo, they lie on kind of a spectrum.
Yeah.
And like, how can you, and sometimes you're just like, okay, well, I'm okay with 3, whatever, you know? I think figuring out where you lie and how you can address address that as important, because I definitely don't see addiction as like this sort of bright line, even though that's what the government has to use and studies have to use to study different populations. But ultimately, like, addiction is determined by someone with a clipboard, right? Who goes, oh yeah, I've talked to you a couple times, you're an addict, whatever. So
yeah, I think Bor Mate in his book The Myth of Normal, like, he does a good job of saying, like, it's in a profoundly sick society, you know, like, it's normal to have all these symptoms that mm-hmm. show that, like, if a normalized behavior is 6 hours a day on technology, or 8 or 10 or whatever it is, it's like, we might look at our peers and go, oh, I'm below them or I'm above them, but it's really the cost of the behavior on our psychology. Mm-hmm. Or because you look at anxiety, depression, how can you not experience anxiety if you're constantly scrolling something that has an unpredictable outcome that you're constantly activated by? I think of the impact. I look today at, like, the level of disease, the level of mm-hmm. obesity, the level of mental health issues, especially in young people. And I'm like, wow, like, do we not want to look at the common denominators that, because they're profitable businesses,
yeah.
you know, and that's sad in some sense, but, and that's where it's like, when will the adults make the choices for the kids, you know? And that's the part where I go, oh, well, like, you look at a kid's experience of an iPad, they know exactly how to use it already. They're just like, the anthropologist who studied, like, how humans hold things, move with things, is, I think, how the origin of how, like, the iPhone was created. Mm. So it's like, they've done a pretty good job, because a kid knows how to use an iPad quickly.
Yeah.
So intuitive. It's like, do you think we need to put in more regulation for young people, for, like, let's say, under 14 or 16?
I think regulation for young people is probably pretty smart. I think I hate regulating behaviors of adults,
yeah.
you know? Obviously, there needs to be some regulation for stuff for adults, but I think generally for kids, especially around social media, that doesn't seem like a bad idea to me. I mean, for example, in China, TikTok is different for a 14-year-old than it is for a 14-year-old in the US. What content gets fed to them, right? Like, I'm sure we can tweak algorithms to, if you're a 14-year-old on social, like, you're going to get more stuff that's educational and interesting,
yeah.
and it's going to improve your life. Like, it's a very simple coding.
That's a smart thing. Idea.
And that's what they do in China.
Right.
And then, you know, shutting it off at certain hours. I know Utah is doing some stuff. I do think that, yeah, when you look at how the human brain is changing during those times and what becomes important, and also what we want our kids doing at this prime learning time, I think it's probably wise to regulate social media for kids and teens.
How do you encourage people to rewire their habits? Because, you know, other than buy the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the book goes into how you can sort of reverse the loop in a lot of different behaviors. And it really is, I think it does come down to tweaking the loops, changing either the reason why you're doing the thing in the first place, the unpredictable rewards, and slowing down the repetition. I mean, I think you see that work consistently in studies. And then asking the bigger why, like I had to do with my, why am I doing this in the first place?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's important.
Yeah. When I consider that relationship to things like social media, part is, oh yeah, I have work on there. I have whatever. But often it is the avoidance of discomfort. It's the avoidance of, like, being with other people or being with feeling, you know?
Yeah.
And so much of what you were talking about in the book that I really, I loved how you pointed it out, but is that so much of these behaviors are actually sourced from trying to, like, the cravings are sourced from this desire to be more valuable,
mm-hmm.
which I think about in the context of relationship. Most often we are seeking relationship from a place of a lack of self-worth. And so the relationship is familiar to us. The dynamic that we might call chemistry is familiar to us. But it's familiar because it activates something that's still incomplete, a familiar relationship we had with a caregiver that made us feel unworthy. So to actually step into worthiness, it's crazy, because then you have to look and go, okay, well, if I love myself and I place myself at high value, what habits, rituals, and choices would I make? Well, the unfortunate thing is that the majority of the things people are currently choosing would probably not line up.
Right.
And then we got to be with the shame and the guilt that comes with the recognition that behaviors we do are harming us.
Mm-hmm.
So in your looking at cravings and this orientation of low self-worth that seems to drive them, how do you think, or what do you recommend people do in order to shift?
Well, I think that, I don't think people do things that, like people do things for a good reason. So even if a behavior is hurting you in the long run, it's probably providing something in the short term, mm-hmm. right? You're getting some sort of benefit from it. So take me in drinking. It's like, I knew that my drinking was causing me long-term problems. But the thing about alcohol for me is that like I can fix my problems immediately with a drink. Like that's pretty damn easy.
Yeah, that's true.
right?
Yeah.
I'm still getting a benefit from drinking. You can extrapolate that all the way to like any drug use, right? Like an addict is always going to feel better in the moment if they just use their drug of choice, even though they know it's ruining their life in the long term. So you're consistently choosing a short-term reward at the expense of a long-term growth and benefits. Yeah. And so I do think really realizing like, I'm going to have to go through this tough period. Like it is going to be hard. It's just part of the bargain and part of the realization. Like that unlocked it for me. I tried to stop drinking 100 times. And every single time I'm looking for like, how could I just have like one or two drinks?
Yeah.
How could I like do this thing? You know, like you're just like messing around. And it's like, sometimes you got to rip the Band-Aid off with some stuff.
And when you increase your capacity for that level of discomfort in one area, you now have it in every area.
Yeah, I think so.
That's why I think of things like rucking or cold water exposure or, you know, breath work or going on adventures to the edge. You know, like you talk about, is that it's a skill that transcends every area of your life. Like if you can be with a craving and say no to it about, let's say, sugar or a processed food or something like that, it's going to translate to choosing a poor partner.
Yeah.
Like it's because it's a skill set. Now you're observational about why you do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm curious now that you've written Comfort Crisis and Scarcity Brain, and this might be jumping the gun, but do you have something that you're already exploring? And
oh God, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, can you stop?
No,
that's your opportunity, your scarcity.
I think it actually is. I said, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to even do a proposal for, at least 6 months, at least 6 months after this comes out. And I literally sent Jan and Steve. So for the listeners, we share agents and their names are Jan and Steve. I sent them a proposal like 2 days ago.
Did you really?
Yeah. I had an idea and I went on a run for like a week and I was like, here's a proposal. I don't know why I am the way I am, but here we are.
Can you share at all what the investigation or where your point of inquiry is now going?
I can tell you it's going to have a big overarching narrative. We're going to start in, so it's basically going to track how, assuming it doesn't change in the proposal state, it's going to track how humans basically got from East Africa where we evolved to the Americas. But what are the important adaptations we picked up along the way that allowed us to do that? Because it turns out that those adaptations are still things that can enhance our life today that we've often overlooked, right? It's like the ability, for example, to tell stories is very uniquely human.
Yeah.
And like most people freaking suck at telling stories.
That's true.
But it turns out that like, if you can tell a good story, that's a really good business hack. That's a good relationship. That's a good friendship hack. That's a good, like you can use that skill in today's day and age.
Yeah, you can monetize that, no problem. But you also socially get rewarded.
Yeah.
And it is the way that we shared information. It was the way that we shared wisdom.
Right.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks again for coming on, man. I'm so happy we got to have another chat.
Super fun. Thank you.
Yeah, for everyone listening, Scarcity Brain, go get it wherever books are sold. Website?
EasterMichael.com. And then, you can find pretty much anything you want through that portal.
Perfect. Thanks, brother.
Yeah, thanks, man.